Warning, the first portion of the following podcast contains a little adult language, some sexual imagery, and not too much stuff to make you say, man, that's not really a dirty play. You have been kind of warned. Skip to the
5 minute, 30 second
mark if super easily offended. Well met. And welcome to episode 131, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for June the 26th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our two-month-long discussion of Macbeth with an in-depth discussion of two major speeches from the play, plus a look at the limited amount of nudge-nudge-wink-wink in Macbeth. So let's start off with the body, get it out of the way. There's not much, so if you want not to hear the dirty, skip to the
5 minute, 30 second
mark in the podcast. Some explicit content, a little adult language, and sexual imagery ahead. Skip if super easily offended. You have been warned. There's not a whole lot of body in Macbeth, or as Eric Partridge, the author of the great Shakespeare's Body, puts it, Macbeth is the purest of the tragedies, and except for the porter scene, pure by any criterion. It's almost as if the play itself said, unsex me here. The first body bit I could find comes in that unsex me here speech by Lady Macbeth. As she takes on a manly aspect, she discusses her keen knife and the wounds it will make. Back when we were discussing Hamlet, we talked about how keen had the concept of an edge, which could be interpreted as having a sexual connotation to it, and a knife is a pretty phallic weapon, but it still feels a bit of a stretch. The next bit of body I find comes in Act 1, Scene 7, when Macbeth is trying to take back his decision to kill Duncan, and Lady Macbeth takes him to task for it. When you durst do it, then you were a man, and to be more than what you were, you would be so much more the man. Nor time, nor place did then adhere, and yet you would make both. They have made themselves, and that their fitness now does unmake you. I suppose the do it in that opening line could refer to screwing. The first man could be a cock, I guess, and the discussion about being more than what you were could be a hard-on. And the does unmake you could be that erection becoming flaccid. But I think that's stretching it a bit as well. I think she's really just talking about masculinity here, not sexuality, though I'm sure some would argue the point. Near the end of Macbeth's Is This a Dagger Which I See Before Me speech, he references the Tarquin's ravishing side, an allusion to the rapist in Shakespeare's own The Rape of Lucrece. Even this reference is less erotic than esoteric. Now we get to the porter scene. We get urine and a discussion of what liquor can provoke. Lechery, sir, it provokes and unprovokes. It provokes the desire, but it takes away the performance. Therefore, much drink may be said to be an equivocator with lechery. It makes him and it mars him. It sets him on and it takes him off. It persuades him and disheartens him. Makes him stand to and not stand to. In conclusion, equivocates him in a sleep, and giving him the lie, leaves him. This is really the only blatant bout of body in the entire play. The porter says that drink brings on lust, but makes it so that the man cannot get it up to perform the act. Stand to is, of course, getting a hard-on. The final image of the speech is how liquor has metaphorically fucked the man. Body? Yes, but it pales to almost every other play we've seen. Later, when the witches are concocting their brew, the third witch tosses in a finger of birth-strangled babe ditch-delivered by a drab. So a whore has delivered a baby in a ditch. Not exactly nudge-nudge-wink-wink-inducing. And finally, Malcolm, when trying to test Macduff in Act 4, Scene 3, the interminable Act 4, Scene 3, he tries to convince Macduff of his sins of lust. But there is no bottom, none in my voluptuousness. Your wives, your daughters, your matrons, and your maids could not fill up the cistern of my lust, and my decision all continent impediments would o'erbear that did oppose my will. Voluptuousness, desire, lust, and will are all terms having a horny meaning. Their use here, however, is so dry that it's no surprise that we learn that it comes from a virgin, yet unknown to woman. And as Porky Pig would say, that's all, folks. It's kind of a limp display, no? That discussion of body isn't even worth lighting up after, so let's turn our attention onto something more exciting, really. Let's take a look at two of the major speeches in the play. As we near the conclusion of the play, Macbeth learns of the death of his wife and responds, "She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." If you focus too much on the word should in that opening line, it makes the line harsh, as if she should have died next, just not right now in the midst of preparation for war. But I don't think that's the intention. Yes, we all die, but she should have died in the future. The line is a short one, 3 feet long. That's a huge pause at the end of this sentence, and that for me indicates that it's the hereafter that we should think about, in the time to come. That sort of poignancy, I think, is supported by scansion of the line, which I feel is kicked off not by an iamb or a spondee, either of which puts the stress on that should, but rather a trochee. She should have died hereafter. This puts the focus on his wife and the time to come. That sense of temporal concern continues in the next line, in which time itself is the stressed syllable in the third iamb. The poignancy, too, is in the scansion. That first foot is an iamb, which puts the stress on the word would. This is the case even for a spondee, and I think there's no way that the first foot is a trochee putting the stress on there. Would, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, meant a conditional or undecided desire or intention. In other words, something for the future. There would have been a time for such a word. The fully iambic line ends with word, a word for which there would have been a time. Not time, mind you, a time. He doesn't just want to put off the word, and I think he's talking about the word died here. He wants it to be put off until its appointed time. This sense of a future time is carried through the famed next line, perfectly iambic save for the feminine ending, that extra unstressed syllable at the end of the line, which allows it to perfectly run on into the next line, which happens to begin with a first syllable stressed trochee. The repetition of tomorrow serves two purposes here. It creates the cycle of language, the time that passes day after day. It also begins a series of verbal repetitions that continues into the next line with repeated sounds, petty, pace, and the repeated words, day to day. These repeated sounds continue to cycle through time like a ticking clock with perfect iambs, four of which complete the line. A metrical perfection broken by the two spondees that open the next line, though it could be argued that the first foot is actually a trochee. And that line also, wonderfully, ironically, elides the last two syllables of the word syllable itself. Creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. The line slows with those heavy stresses at the beginning, but then rushes through the polysyllabic word syllable, calling attention to the language and the concept of recorded time. And think of the concept of a record as a kind of doubling. It existed once, and now we also have a record of it. It's as if this line is the one that slows him down, gives him pause, makes him realize what has happened. The next line and a half takes the poetic concept of multiple tomorrows and juxtaposes it with a single yesterday, which creates a light for fools. The darkness of his world without her is implied. The poetry also returns the rhythms to iamb, ending the sentence again with consonants, dusty, death. The next sentence kicks off with two consecutive spondees, again using monosyllabic words until the feminine ending of the line. This slows him down. Now he is giving pause to the line, not the other way around. And without out brief candle, that light for fools has been extinguished, and he is broken. And what follows is trochee, I am, trochee, caesura, I am, trochee. The broken rhythms of a broken man. A man who sees his existence as a shadow in an already dark world, as a mere actor playing the part of a real man. Ironically, though, he may be broken, but he's not bowed. The next line, save for the two-syllable hour elided into one, is iambic and filled with repeated sounds, struts and frets and struts and stage, which continues what was started in the line before, poor player. This sentence ends with a spondee, no more. Even the story, the life of the player, comes to an end. The last sentence of the speech, after an initial trochee, is relatively iambic, save for the two elisions and a feminine ending, thus returning him to poetic regularity, normality. If the player is but a shadow, then its playwright is no better, a mere idiot, not even a full one, as the three-syllable word is elided to two syllables in the line. The sentence and the speech ends abruptly with nothing before the end of its line. The pause there allows us to take it all in, to internalize it. It's also a chance for the actor to take a breath, a half-line pause, before he must go back to his warlike preparation, one that will lead to the end, to the negation of many. The respite is done. Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who are asking for bigger poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website. Now let's take a look at another speech, this one from the opposite end of the play. Upon hearing the news of both Macbeth's meeting with the witches and Duncan's imminent arrival at Inverness, Lady Macbeth states her newfound purpose. The raven himself is hoarse that croaks the fatal entrance of Duncan under my battlements. Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here, and fill me from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood. Stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts, and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers, wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief. Come, thick night, and pall thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold. Interestingly, this invocation to spirits comes just a handful of lines after she states her intention to pour her spirits into Macbeth's ear to convince him to kill the king. The first sentence of the speech, bookended by half lines of broken scansion, points out to the listener that nature itself, in the form of the raven, is aware of Duncan's fate. Lady Macbeth also takes ownership of the entire castle, my battlements. And then she invokes spirits of supernatural power with two line-ending trochees, and her wish for them to unsex her, to take her gender, and to make her a man. Her vision of an unsexed woman, a man, is one of direst cruelty, and this male has blood thick enough to stop any remorse. She claims that it's natural to feel regret, compunctious, after such an act as kill the king or nature's mischief, and thus this nature stands between the purpose and the act, the effect in it. She must stop nature or make it mischievous. Compare this to what we saw in Nature in King Lear. She then calls for her breast milk to be replaced by gall or black bile. Now, this I find fascinating. Way back when we were discussing Hamlet, I discussed the four humors. A lack of black bile or gall would make one sanguine, typically courageous, hopeful, playful, and carefree. An excess of gall, which is what she's asking for, however, would make you melancholy, typically quiet, analytical, serious, and, oh yeah, despondent. Looking ahead to Act 5, is this a case of be careful what you wish for? The subjects of her invocation, these spirits, she also calls murdering ministers who can be disguised in the air as sightless substances. She also calls upon Thick Night. Is this too a murdering minister, or is this different? Regardless, we get very interesting imagery at the end of the speech. Her keen knife is going to make wounds, and we've seen before how keen can take on a sexual connotation. And knife? Could there be a more phallic weapon? Unsex me, she says. Remove my femaleness, my femininity. Make me a man, an analytical killer without remorse, wielding a phallic weapon. That's one vision of manliness, I suppose. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last podcast, you've missed out on subjects including Sources, Part 1, OUP Blog, Witches, Guest Column, Imagining a Future, Shakespeare, A Theatrical Conversation with Fiona Shaw, Review, Sources, Part 2, BBC and Shakespeare's Globe, The Complete Walk, Macbeth, Macbeth Movie Madness, Sources, History? Macbeth and Equivocation, Macbeth Movie Madness, Brett vs. Stewart, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, Macbeth Movie Madness, Pertwee vs. Branagh, Unsex Me Here. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page or Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets, however, are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. Join us again for our next podcast. Hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for June 26, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.